Today is Monday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. World leaders gather in Glasgow, Scotland at the climate summit. Will they come up with meaningful targets to reduce climate change?
The UN countries who sign on to a pact in 1992 that essentially says that the planet is in trouble, and if we don't change our behavior, the planet will die.
The G20 leaders wrap up their summit in Rome, but only make mild pledges on climate neutrality.
The countries most responsible for historic and present-day emissions are not yet doing their fair share of the work.
And hundreds of vaccinated foreign tourists are set to arrive in Bangkok. Those stories and more coming up right here on The Voice of America. Stay tuned. The 26th United Nations Conference of Parties on Climate Change, or COP26, got underway on Sunday in Glasgow, Scotland. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuskwara traveled with U.S. President Joe Biden from the G20 summit in Rome to the climate summit in Scotland. I asked her what is topping the climate conference agenda.
COP26 is essentially the conference of parties, and it's the 26th times that we've done this. And by parties, we mean the UN countries who sign on to a pact in 1992 that essentially says that the planet is in trouble, and if we don't change our behavior, the planet will die. This is, of course, all about climate change. And the big idea here is to achieve global warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius, ideally by 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, since we've had that first 1992 meeting, COP meeting, there are a couple of big landmark agreements. The first one is, of course, the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, where we all say, yes, we need to achieve the target of reducing global warming to 1.5 degrees or below to 2 degrees. And the way we do that is by slashing greenhouse emissions 50% by 2030, and then reaching net zero or no emissions at all by around mid-century. And so that's a big issue. And so we'll see in the next couple of days how world leaders will tackle this existential threat of climate change.
How achievable is that kind of outlook when you're talking about two major countries not attending?
So that's essentially a big issue, not just at COP26, but also at the G20. If you look at it, the G20 was done on Saturday and Sunday, and then we have the COP26 on Monday and Tuesday, and that is a diplomatic design. You want to go into one summit of the 20 largest world economies into this broader summit, and you want to talk about climate change at the same time. And then at G20, where you're supposed to start with like a good momentum heading into COP26, what we had was a really lukewarm, a very tepid kind of communique with China and Russia not being able to commit to any new pledges in terms of reducing their global greenhouse emissions. So yes, it's really sad and disappointing, actually, as President Joe Biden said in his press conference last night in Rome, of which I was a part of. And we'll see, you know, I mean, these are large emitters, not just China and Russia, but also oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia, also other large greenhouse emitters like Indonesia, like Brazil. All of us will have to work together to get to reach these very ambitious goal of reducing global warming.
And so, the way you see it now, as you have laid it out, how difficult will that be to reach a really significant kind of target that includes the biggest emitters in the world, and that they will sign on to this agreement?
It's certainly a heavy lift because, number one, there was no agreement at the G20 from the world's major economies to phase out coal consumption, right? That is the big key issue because that is really the largest driver of greenhouse emissions. There was no agreement to phase out coal. I mean, there was an agreement to stop public financing of international coal plants abroad, but no plans domestically. That's number one. The second point is that there's this unfulfilled promise from developed nations to help developing countries to mitigate climate change, to transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy. So this is a commitment that was made, $100 billion a year, and much of that money has not materialized. So developing countries like Indonesia, like South Africa, as well as China, is saying, we want a healthier planet. We want to transition to renewable energy, but we need help to do that from developing nations in the form of this international climate financing, $100 billion a year, and much of that money has not materialized.
Just one more question for you, Patsy, since you're the White House bureau chief. How important is this for Biden himself?
It's very important because, as you recall, President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2000 climate agreement in Paris. And so there is a huge lack of leadership in terms of the U.S. role on the global stage in climate change. And so President Joe Biden really wants to show up strong and say that the U.S. is back. We are concerned again on the issue of climate change, and we are going to do our part. So this is the stage where President Joe Biden will try to show that America is indeed back and ready to lead again in terms of climate change.
That was White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittek-Kuskwara speaking with me from Edinburgh, Scotland. As we just heard, the leaders of the Group of 20 world economies wrapped up their two-day summit in Rome just ahead of the climate conference with mild pledges on climate neutrality and coal financing. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more on that story.
Leaders of the world's biggest economies have agreed to stop funding coal-fired power plants in poor countries. They've also made a vague commitment to seek carbon neutrality by or around mid-century. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the G20 commitments drops in a rapidly warming ocean.
The countries most responsible for historic and present-day emissions are not yet doing their fair share of the work. If we are going to prevent COP26 from being a failure, then that must change. And I must be clear that if Glasgow fails, then the whole thing fails.
President Biden says he was disappointed, too.
Not only Russia, but China basically didn't show up in terms of any commitments to deal with climate change.
I'm Ben Thomas.
French President Emmanuel Macron said Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison lied to him over the cancellation of a submarine building contract in September. Reuters correspondent Libby Hogan reports.
French President Emmanuel Macron said Australia's leader, Scott Morrison, lied to him over a cancelled submarine contract. It's the latest shot fired between the two countries, as both leaders were in Rome for the G20, meeting for the first time since Australia ditched the multi-billion dollar deal with France. Macron spoke to a group of Australian reporters on the sidelines of the summit.
I have a lot of respect for your country. I have a lot of respect and a lot of friendship for your people. I do say when we have respect, you have to be true and you have to behave in line and consistently with this value.
Do you think he lied to you?
I don't think. I know.
Australia formed a new security alliance with Britain and the US known as AUKUS in September. They then announced a new order for nuclear-powered submarines. Macron says AUKUS caught them off guard, and later France recalled its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. Speaking at the conference, Morrison then fired back at Macron. He said he had explained to Macron that the conventional submarines would no longer meet Australia's needs and that they were already rebuilding their ties. On Friday, US President Joe Biden said he had thought France had been informed of the contract cancellation before the AUKUS pact was announced, but that the handling of the new agreement had been clumsy.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the history and experiences of the African diaspora and how their connection to the continent has changed over generations. We'll also profile young Americans of African descent making their mark in U.S. politics. Join me, Heidi Adams, for the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Hundreds of vaccinated foreign tourists are scheduled to arrive in Bangkok on Monday, the first wave of visitors to Thailand in 18 months who will not have to undergo quarantine for the coronavirus. Reuters correspondent Jason Albano reports.
Thailand opened its gates to fully vaccinated tourists on Monday, welcoming the first wave of visitors in 18 months who will not have to quarantine in a hotel. German tourist Carlotta Tiris was one of the first to arrive in the capital, Bangkok.
Definitely diving, because Koh Tao is just incredible for that. And then, of course, the food is insane. So Bangkok's street food really surprised me, because I've never had that, and I'm very looking forward to that again.
Thailand gave the green light to vaccinated tourists from more than 60 countries, hoping to revive its ravaged tourism economy. That includes several in Northern Europe, where the cold has begun to set in. Simon Reitel and his friends are visiting from Germany.
In Europe, as you know, it's quite cold, so we decided to go here. And this was just randomly picked the first flight. As we saw that it's reopened, we just picked this flight and were quite surprised that we were the first flight which arrived.
Before the global health crisis began, tourism accounted for more than a tenth of Thailand's GDP. Bangkok ranked at the top of most visited cities in the world. But in early 2020, the government imposed strict entry rules, in the process losing 3 million tourism-dependent jobs, as well as an estimated $50 billion a year in revenue. Monday wasn't a complete reset yet, however. Tourists will still have to stay at a pre-approved hotel for their first night and test negative upon arrival before they can freely travel around the country.
That was Reuters reporter Jason Albano. Australians are being allowed to travel overseas without COVID-19 restrictions for the first time in almost 600 days. Before now, they needed government permission to go overseas under strict measures designed to curb the spread of the coronavirus. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
After more than 18 months, Australia is reconnecting with the world as vaccination rates increase. There were tearful reunions at Sydney Airport as the first overseas passengers landed after restrictions came to an end. Australians can now travel freely overseas without needing official permission. Returning travellers flying home into the states of New South Wales and Victoria no longer face mandatory hotel quarantine. They must, however, be double vaccinated, and only Australian citizens, permanent residents and their immediate families can return home at this stage. Australia will reopen quarantine-free entry to fully vaccinated Singaporeans from November 21. But it's unclear when other foreign nationals, who've been mostly banned since March 2020, will be permitted to enter. Thousands of Australians have been stranded overseas during the pandemic by some of the world's toughest border controls. Authorities placed limits on the number of travellers allowed back because of constraints on the quarantine system. Melbourne Airport has also been preparing for the resumption of large-scale passenger numbers. Chief Executive Lyle Strambi says pandemic border closures have been hard on staff.
We haven't really stopped flying, so we've been able to keep things working and making sure that everything's in great shape. But the stop-start nature of the whole episode we've been through has been, you know, really tough. In particular, you know, for the employees at the airport, we'd normally have 20,000 people working at the airport. I think a few times they were down to as low as 500 people. So it's been really hard on those individuals in particular.
Internal border controls remain in parts of Australia. Residents in Sydney and Melbourne, for example, can now fly freely to Paris, France, but not to Perth in Western Australia. Travellers from New South Wales and Victoria, which have been at the centre of Delta variant outbreaks this year, can only enter Western Australia with an approved exemption permit and must be double vaccinated. Queensland state authorities plan to ease their internal border restrictions on December 17. Australia has diagnosed 170,000 coronavirus cases during the pandemic. 1,700 people have died. More than 77% of eligible Australians have been fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The global death toll from COVID-19 has surpassed 5 million, nearly 2 years into a crisis that has not only devastated poor countries, especially those in Africa, but also humbled the most developed nations of the world with first-rate healthcare systems. Together, the United States, the European Union, Britain, and Brazil account for one-eighth of the world's population, but nearly half of all reported COVID deaths. The U.S. alone has recorded over 740,000 lives lost. That's more than any other country. Experts say the death toll is almost certainly an undercount because of limited testing and people dying at home without receiving medical care, especially in poor parts of the world, such as India. Ethiopia's prime minister has called on his supporters to redouble their efforts in the country's war, as Tigray forces claim to have seized key cities that control a major highway toward the capital. A move on the capital, Addis Ababa, would signal a new phase in the war that has killed thousands of people since fighting broke out almost a year ago between Ethiopian government troops and Tigray forces in the country's northern region. The prime minister's spokeswoman did not immediately respond to a question from the Associated Press on Monday about Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's whereabouts or travel plans. China's growing military muscle and its push to end American predominance in the Asia-Pacific is rattling the U.S. defense establishment. American officials see trouble on the horizon on several fronts: Beijing's expanding nuclear arsenal, its advances in space, cyber, and missile technologies, and threats to Taiwan. At stake is a potential shift in the global balance of power that has favored the U.S. for decades. A realignment that is more favorable to China does not pose a direct threat to the U.S., but could complicate America's alliances in Asia. New signs of how the Biden administration will deal with the China challenge may emerge in the coming weeks as the White House reviews nuclear weapons, global troop basing, and overall defense strategy. The Taliban-appointed supervisor of a small district hospital outside the Afghan capital has big plans, which has got doctors there worried. The Associated Press reports doctors are demanding past due salary payments amid critical shortages of medicine, food, and fuel. The new Taliban administrator's top priority is to build a mosque inside the hospital quarters, segregate staff by gender, and encourage them to pray. VOA's International Edition continues. Researchers in Indonesia have found a way to fight disease-bearing mosquitoes by breeding a species of the insect that carries a kind of bacteria that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside them. Reuters correspondent Brian Wood reports.
Researchers in Indonesia are fighting mosquito-borne diseases with more mosquitoes, but these are carrying a secret weapon. A joint study has been releasing lab-bred mosquitoes in the city of Yogyakarta, targeting red zones for dengue fever. But these bugs carry Wolbachia, a common bacteria found in over half of insect species that prevents viruses like dengue from growing inside them. It's not, however, found in Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, which often carry dengue, according to the nonprofit World Mosquito Program. Purwanti is with the group.
In principle, we are breeding the good mosquitoes. The mosquitoes carrying dengue will mate with mosquitoes carrying the Wolbachia bacteria, and we hope to produce Wolbachia mosquitoes, or the good ones.
WMP trial results showed this method reduced dengue cases by nearly 80% and hospitalizations by nearly 90%. Sri Purwangsi is a local in Yogyakarta and a research volunteer.
All three of my children have been infected with dengue and hospitalized. It's always on my mind, thinking about how to keep my village healthy.
Global dengue infections have risen rapidly in recent decades, according to the World Health Organization. About half of the world's population is now at risk, with an estimated 100 to 400 million infections reported every year.
That was Reuters correspondent Brian Wood.
This is Science in a Minute.
When astronomers say they discovered a supernova, what they actually saw are the after effects or remains of a massive star's exploding death. It can be compared to investigating an auto accident after it occurred. Until recently, scientists haven't really witnessed a supernova before or during its explosive fate. Astronomers using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and other space and ground-based observatories were able to make extraordinary observations of the first moments of a star's catastrophic death. It's thought such observations could provide scientists with an early warning of a star's demise. Called SN 2020 FQV, the observed supernova is located in what is known as the Interacting Butterfly Galaxies, located about 60 million light-years away in the constellation Virgo. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It was another rough weekend for travelers in the United States, with American Airlines canceling around 1,600 flights. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
American cites windy conditions in Texas and a shortage of flight attendants. By midday Sunday, American had canceled more than 700 flights. That's after scrapping nearly 900 on Friday and Saturday, according to FlightAware. The disruptions were similar in their initial cause and size to problems suffered in early October by Southwest Airlines, which at the time canceled well over 2,000 flights. And it raises questions about whether major airlines are prepared for the busy upcoming holiday travel period. American and Southwest say they've stepped up hiring. I'm Julie Walker.
Two trains collided at Fisherton Tunnel in the southwestern English city of Salisbury on Sunday, injuring a number of people. Police declared it a major incident. Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson has that report.
Two passenger trains crashed in southwest England on Sunday, injuring several people. Police confirmed there were no fatalities after the collision in a tunnel in the city of Salisbury. However, authorities have declared it a major incident, and a small number of people, including the driver, have been taken to hospital. According to a BBC report, the rear carriage of one of the trains derailed after striking an object. The second train then collided with it due to signalling problems. Passengers described shock and confusion.
There was just suddenly a lot of jostling, possessions being thrown around. I think a few people went forward and hit their heads and things like that.
Yeah, just this massive impact, and I fell across the table, and then the table came off the wall, ended up underneath another table. But they've smashed the window and stuff, and we've got out of the window, so we're hopefully, well, we're safe now. But yeah, it was really scary.
The Dorset and Wiltshire Fire and Rescue Service said it has helped evacuate approximately 100 people. A casualty centre has been opened at a nearby church to treat those with minor injuries. Train services are expected to be disrupted until Tuesday.
That was Reuters correspondent Flora Bradley Watson reporting. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has inducted an eclectic class of musicians for 2021 for a show that will air in the United States on November 20th. AP music correspondent Margie Zaraletta reports.
It's Eminem performing with LL Cool J for LL's induction into the Rock Hall. Todd Rundgren was a no-show for his, while Tina Turner accepted by video, noting that if she's still getting awards at the age of 81, she must be doing something right. The Foo Fighters performs with Paul McCartney for their induction. Carole King gets in for a second time. Jay-Z is in, the first time on the ballot. Belinda Carlisle and Gina Shock of the Go-Go's say they're amazed they were ever considered.
We had no idea what we were doing when we started in 1978, so, and here we are.
We still don't know what we're doing.
We still don't know.
I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Many Afghans displaced in recent fighting have yet to receive aid as winter sets in. One group of women near Kabul said the cold, dire conditions have claimed the lives of several newborn babies. Reuters reporter Lucy Fielder has more.
Displaced Afghan families called for help on Sunday, saying newborn babies are dying because of the winter cold. There have been warnings Afghanistan could face a catastrophic famine this winter, and humanitarian aid has begun to trickle in. But none of it has reached this group of displaced people. This woman gave her name as Halima.
So far, around 4 to 5 babies were born here, and then they died due to the cold. Yesterday, an elderly man and a child who went on the streets to earn money for buying food had a car accident and both died. We are in a very tough situation.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has said about 50,000 Afghans from different provinces who were displaced by recent conflicts have moved to Kabul. Even before the Taliban's victory over the Western-backed government in Kabul 2 months ago, more than 18 million Afghans, or about half the population, needed humanitarian aid, according to the UNHCR. The freezing weather underlined the urgency in getting assistance to thousands of displaced. Many have fled from the provinces and are sleeping in tents or improvised accommodation around the city.
That is Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder reporting. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us today. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day, at voanews.com. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.